When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we run into your knife. We run into your knife 10 times. My name is Caroline O'Donoghue, and if I had just one more brain cell, what a halfwit I would be. Joining me is Mistress Mama Morton, the Countess of the Clink, Natasha Hodgson.
That's the only introduction I've ever wanted in my entire life.
To be the Countess of the Clink.
Mistress Mama Morton. Today we're going to talk about cabaret.
Hello, yes, I am Tash Hodgson, long-time appreciator of both you, your work, and indeed the movie Chicago.
Chicago.
Which we're going to talk about today.
Not just a long-term fan of both me and Chicago, which both I appreciate. Mm-hmm. You're also the writer of musicals.
Musical, so far musical single.
Yeah.
But indeed, there is no denying that, yes, I am a quarter of the brain that has written the musical Operation Mincemeat. Yay! Which we're happy about because we've just basically, in recent times, announced that we're going to take our little musical to the West End starting end of March 2023. So we're really stoked. It's been a long old journey to get us here. You saw it back when it first...
Yeah. Yeah,
when it was a tiny little 80-seater, we had two hats between us and a lot of vim.
I think maybe like what 5 years ago you first started telling me that you were going to write this musical.
I think it's going to be my money spinner.
No, you got any money?
It's funny thinking about making money out of theatre. Which in many ways is what this is all going to be about.
The craziest dream of all. It's interesting having, you know, known you for so many years and also seen you write your musical. The knowledge that, like, musicals go through so many revisions until they're basically these perfect sort of machines that can work by themselves. Yeah. They have to be so good that you can, like, transplant them anywhere that anyone will understand them. And how much has, like, writing a musical improved your... like critical appreciation for how flawless Chicago is.
Oh my God. I mean, if I had any idea how hard it was to write even a vaguely good musical, I never would have even bought that. I'm so glad I was so ignorant. Like, there is not a single moment in Chicago that isn't completely perfect. That is our official opinion on the... I mean, I'm going to talk mainly about the movie Chicago, just because that's the one that's sort of buried mm-hmm. into both of our hearts. But I think, yeah, from the opening frame and the opening seconds of that movie, which again, we were going to talk about, like, it was a huge, huge inspiration for me. And I think for the other guys, three other guys who write the musical with me, just in terms of like... what each song has to do, what your opener has to do, how your sort of I Want song has to sort of follow from that. And it's like, there's real maths to creating a great musical that I did not appreciate at all. But I think even being like sort of 12 or 13 or whatever, when I first saw this film, something like within it was like, this is as you say, it is a perfect machine. And although I don't understand why each cog is so perfectly tuned to what it's doing, there's like a weird, beyond the actual music within the very structure of a great musical that just makes you feel happy. Like, it just, you feel so safe watching Chicago. That's all I've ever wanted. Like, if someone comes out of Operation Mincemeat and says, I felt very safe.
Well, that's the thing. It's being in safe hands. You know, I remember a few years ago when you and I were watching Drag Race and we were judging these two last contestants, and like, what you have to think about is if all the lights went off, if there's a power cut in this club, ugh, could this person put on this show alone? Mm-hmm. And I can't do it alone.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of that.
And it's like, I would watch Chicago on the street.
If someone walked in right now and said, girls, the radio needs you to do an entire rendition of Chicago, could the two of us do it? I think...
frame for frame.
Frame for frame.
Could recreate.
We could fucking bring the house down. But no, yeah, that's the thing. Like, and I think in some ways that was quite a good way to make a musical, because we, when we started making it and when we first performed it, I mean, all the way through we performed it, really, like, we don't have, or we didn't have, the kind of spectacle of like the lights and the costumes and the, all the rest of it. All we had really was just like, do these songs speak to people? Do they make them feel excited? Do the characters sort of, you know, mesh with people and make them feel stuff? And I think, although it made it incredibly difficult and meant the process was longer, I think ultimately it served us really well, because I think hopefully what that's meant is that we have come to a place where we've ironed out every wrinkle. Like, well, I'll say that we've ironed out enough wrinkles that it feels like a machine that now works.
Yeah.
Because yeah, as you say, like, ultimately, if someone said to us tomorrow, you know, if we open this big West End show and it's, you know, a lovely success, and someone said to us, there's no, you know, the whole building's collapsed, but the people are here, can you do it?
Yeah, can you do it in the road?
Can you do it? Yeah, and will people still clap? And will people still enjoy it? I mean, hopefully with our musical, yes. But I mean, with Chicago, 1,000%. There is just, if you've got the performers and you've got, like, yeah, you've got a PA system with a with an iTunes karaoke function, yeah, there's people having the time of their lives.
You said something a minute ago about the idea of an I want song.
Yes.
And would you say that there are, like, within the structure of a musical, there has to be certain songs that do certain jobs, and that's kind of like the clockwork mechanism of how a musical has to work?
So it's super fascinating. Like, so this is the thing that I had no idea before I started making a musical. Like, I'd written plays with songs in them before, but yeah, I sort of came to learn that there are these things that are in most, a lot of musicals that kind of, in a way that I think, like, you know, you're a novelist, and I think, I don't know if you know this, Caroline, I'm sorry to break this. You're not, but, like, you know, there are certain arcs and journeys and stuff that people go on that are satisfying narratively, that, you know, you have the building blocks of how they go. And I think, yeah, for a musical, yeah, so you, there's a such thing called as the I Want song, as you mentioned, which is basically the song that your main character sings near the very beginning of the show that kind of sets out their intention. And it's kind of like, once you know something like that, you can't help but look for it in everything that you then see. So yeah, obviously in Chicago, it's Roxy singing Roxy, you know, the name on everybody's lips is gonna be, and like, it's, that's her mission. In Hamilton, it's My Shot. In The Little Mermaid, it's the song she sings about the fork.
The great fork anthem.
The tribute to the humble fork. As I was talking there, I was like, you get into Ariel, you gotta remember the name of that song. What's it called?
Part of Your World.
Thank you. Yes, Part of Your World. As I call it, the fork anthem.
I always remember about that song. I knew a girl who went to stage school. And she said that everyone, obviously that was the little girl song that every girl sang, of thing.
Like that, and like Mulan, the, who is that girl I see? Anyway.
But she always talked about, because, you know, when you're a sort of stage school kid, you enunciate every word perfectly clearly. She said every single girl would do that song the same way, where they went, you want thingamabobs? I've got 20.
I've got 20. Not one more.
Not 20.
Not 20.
20.
Yeah. It's annoying. The thing is, you can't win there, because you go, I got 20. You're like, shut up.
I've got 20.
Shut up, you're 7. You're 7.
You have 20 of anything.
20 is a number staggeringly vaster than you can comprehend.
If you had 20 Beanie Babies, I'd be amazed.
Oh my God.
And I think you were lying.
That's amazing. But yeah, so I think basically, yeah, there's a few different, like, and obviously as all these things, reels are made to be broken and you don't have to follow everything. But basically, songs can fall into two main categories in a musical, which is room songs and corridor songs.
Oh, fuck!
Oh, yeah, we're getting into it now. You didn't know what was going to happen. And so, yeah, room songs are where basically, it's like in the kind of joke musical, be like, gosh, I wish I had a spork. Wish I had my fork. And it would be like, so like most I Want songs are room songs. It's basically just an exploration of the thing that you have stated. You don't go anywhere. You're staying in you're learning more about the room. You're describing the sofa. So it's kind of like, oh, if only I had this thing, then you're going to, the whole song's going to be about that one thing. Mm-hmm. So I'd say, like, yeah, I think so for example, in Chicago, like a room song would be something like All That Jazz, where it's kind of like, you just start off, you're in it, it's amazing, it ends. They're showing you the world.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
All That Jazz is Chicago's Under the Sea, isn't it?
Who's Sebastian in Chicago?
Velma, obviously. Velma's Sebastian. A professional.
much professional who will do what it takes to keep the people entertained.
Every time I watch Little Mermaid.
King Triton must be a difficult audience to... That's a hard gig. Because he has to also, like, all his daughters have to be in every number. Like, imagine that as, like, a composer.
The Nepo baby.
Oh, my God. Imagine how many good mermaids are out there, like, could I? And he's like, I'm sorry.
No, it's...
Once again, it's the Christmas.
It's Ariel and her slag sisters.
Ariel and her slutty sisters.
It's a double episode about both Chicago and the Little Mermaids.
Anyway.
I'm going to list it in the podcast, Claire. Chicago brackets Little Mermaids.
Yeah, just don't even start about it. But so, yeah, so but like a corridor song in Chicago. I guess in the movie version, it would be Razzle Dazzle. Although, like, because in that, basically, the corridor song, you don't end the same place that you began in the song. So, like, you start off somewhere, and it's more of a kind of, and we're going off and doing something, gonna do something, we're doing this thing, and you end in a different position. But, like, I guess, yeah, in the movie version, I think in the movie version, they actually turn quite a lot of stuff from room songs into corridor songs, which is one of the reasons I love it so much. So, like, for example, in the opening, which I think we should talk about in much more detail, you know, you begin the song having no idea who anyone is, and by the end of the opener, you've got so much plot has been uncovered to you. Like, you've got the you understand about the Velma sister murder. You get the fact that she's taken her sister's place and has killed somebody. You also have Roxy's story is completely clear. She's come to the club. She's seen the thing. She's going home with Fred Casely. And, like, that's the life that she wants. And that's all just in the backdrop of all that jazz. It's amazing.
It's so... And it also, it's that real rewarding on the rewatch thing as well. Of, like, I mean, it's hard to imagine now a version of myself who hasn't seen Chicago. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I'm trying to... PC and, like, before Chicago and post-Chicago.
But, like, because now I've just, you know, came out in 2000. And I was 12 and I saw it that year, and I've probably watched it like either every year or every other year since then. So, but every time it comes on again, all those like satisfying moments where you, because like what would have been the easy thing to do would be show the murder pre-credits or something.
Yeah.
And then you have Velma showing up to the show. But it's quite subtle, actually. It's just a lot of subtleties together rather than one big obvious thing. So it's like she, there's kind of her hand, the blood stain on the hand, ripping at the poster
Velma and Veronica.
Yes.
Like rips it down.
And like people, and if you're watching it first viewing, you might just get that Velma's late.
Yes.
Because lots of people, oh, where the fuck have you been?
Kind
of
like,
yeah, exactly. And then
but always... and you don't see her face until that first notes of all that jazz as well, which is just like, ugh.
And the thing of like her sort of motioning to the stage manager to move the spotlight because there's not going to be a second person on stage. Mm-hmm.
And it's also like, what's beautiful about that is like, that's the whole movie. That's the everything about the movie is move that spotlight over to me.
Oh, yes!
Like it's like even before that, what's amazing about this movie, like we obviously wax talk about this movie, but like I think what Chicago does so successfully, and the reason it is so successful, is that it gives it a solid premise and like a thing, which is this is a movie through Roxy's eyes. Mm. This is an imaginary musical through Roxy's eyes. And actually, the very first shot of the movie is just an eye, which you go into, which is Roxy's eye.
Yes.
And I just think that was so... I know that they had a bunch of different scripts when they were thinking about making it. And there was a few years, like, different directors came on and then, like, were fired or whatever. But the director, Rob Glorious...
Marshall?
Bob Marshall, thanks so much. There's also a Gary Marshall. I was like, it's not Gary, is it? and it was Rob Marshall's directorial like feature debut, but he came to the studio to Miramax and said, I think it should be Roxy's show and it's through her eyes we're seeing this whole thing. And I think what that gave them was the thing that is so hard to do in a musical on screen, which is the freedom to not have people just burst into song from a scene that they're in, because that's almost impossible to get right. And like I think having seen, I watched have you seen the new West Side Story?
No.
The Steven Spielberg West Side, and it's like has some of the most beautiful moments I've ever seen in my eyes. Like it's just crazy. And yet because it is that thing, unfortunately, depending on your viewpoint, of like, I'm a character, I've been having this conversation, and now we are in a different place. I found that transition quite jarring. I do find it jarring in lots of movie musicals in a way that doesn't happen on stage because you're in a sort of heightened place, which maybe we can talk about later. But with Chicago, by putting that premise on top of it, and having these two completely separate worlds of the real world of what's happening and the vaudeville club where all the numbers take place, and then you can sort of blur the lines of those things. It just means that everything becomes beautiful and easy and like, and free from the embarrassment of just, I'm a man with a job. My costume is my job. I could see all my items from my job.
Yes.
And now I begin the song. Because it's just like, it's so hard to do that, man. It's so hard to do. Have you seen the Andrew Garfield Tick, Tick, Boom?
No, I haven't.
On Netflix. So that's a really interesting example. So Lin-Manuel Miranda directed it. Mm-hmm. And it's an Andrew Larson who wrote the musical Rent. It's the show he wrote before he wrote Rent. It's called Tick, Tick, Boom. And it's about a writer trying to make money out of musicals and failing. And it's all fun for all of us. But it's kind of like, it was the musical. Yeah, it's his much less famous musical. And so, Lin-Manuel Miranda, obviously famous for writing and starring in Hamilton, made a film version of it, and it came out quite recently. And I feel like as a fellow musical theatre writer, he had also sort of grappled with the same thing of like, how do you make musicals on stage work on telly? Because there's lots of strange and interesting stylistic choices where sometimes they kind of burst into song, but sometimes the whole front of the like house will move away and you go into the song that way to kind of go, this is not real, this is stylized, don't worry about it, like it's not embarrassing. They're singing, but it's cool.
And but I think, of course it is embarrassing,
but it's still embarrassing because it's I have this whole theory about like I think the reason Muppet movies work so well is because, like, as musicals, is because like they immerse you instantly in like a heightened world.
Yes, it's so true.
And you're already in that bargain of like you're already in that like world of like, these puppets are people and they're important and they're friends with people. And like, and you go into that being like, yes, I agree to that reality. That is total sense to me. And so when you throw in songs and people burst into songs, you're already in a kind of bargain with the people who've made the movie anyway. It's already, you're already in a bit of like a silent club of like, yeah, sure. We agree that this is not real, but it is real.
And I guess if you think about it, all the very few successful movie musicals that there are that like were made post like the 60s, obviously, kind of the Busby Berkeley era from the 30s and going forward to the 60s, that there was a kind of a pact with the audience that everyone was just willing to buy.
Yeah.
But I feel like in modern cinema, that pact is far more reluctantly signed.
Yeah, I think that's true. And because now we're not in like the golden age. We're very nostalgic for the golden age without actually wanting to buy into the realities of what that would mean to be in the golden age.
Exactly. And it's like the ones that work and that live in everyone's hearts are like Grease. And if you you zoom into that world and they're already in this mad costume.
Yeah,
this, like,
and they're all already 35-year-olds.
They're 35-year-olds, 17-year-olds, and they're wearing these mad wax jackets.
It's like John Travolta. And I feel like if you have a mad star power thing, that can maybe see you through. But I do think, completely. And I think there's a reason, actually, that a lot of movie musicals focus on showbiz and are about show business. I mean, like, this is about show business, cabaret, like Singing in the Rain and like La La Land. And I think it's because you have a very easy access to like that. You're already in that world and you're already in the world of like showbiz and singing and dancing. And so to do one more step to go, and now they're going to do some of that stuff for you. You're so enmeshed in that world that it doesn't feel as embarrassing.
Exactly.
As like if it was like, he's a car mechanic and he's got a dream to sing. Like,
that's why it's so smart with Roxy, where it's like, we're willing to buy the psychological thing of this is somebody who thinks in musical numbers.
Yes,
and
exactly.
So we're like, fine. I'm in.
I'm in.
We just need that like permission slip.
Yeah.
And it's so sad. It's like,
what does it say about
enjoy us? Enjoy our lovely songs.
That we're just like, we cannot fathom the idea that someone would sing. It is too embarrassing. It is too personal.
That's it.
It's too difficult. But for like, and I think because stage is already embarrassing. I can say that as
someone who spent
my entire career trying to do plays on stage. Like, you, in order to walk into a theatre and sit down, you've already succumbed to the fact that you're going to have an embarrassing time. Like, you're sitting and you're watching people, like, act and in the worst case scenario, sing and dance as well. Like, but you're kind of like, well, you've paid your money, you're sitting here, it will happen
Watch
to
me
you.
Pretend.
Watch me pretend to be this guy. My little clothes on that aren't really my clothes. And there's obviously, like, because we've, done it for millennia, there's obviously something in us that really likes that, but I do think there is just a perennial, like, It's just so so lame, man.
Give me permission.
Give me permission. But once that is, and I think also that's the reason that I think musicals often need a lot of money spent on them, because like that gives you that heightened like, don't worry about it. Like, this is decadence. Mm-hmm. This is expensive. Like, money has gone into this. So your choices cannot be bad.
But that's the thing. It's like the permission slip that Chicago writes you, apart from Roxy, is the fact that it's set the 1920s, and that costumery, it just gives you something, right?
It's so fit. It's just everyone looks so great the whole way through,
right? The drop waist, the bobbed hair, like it's this like cartoony, over the top world already.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, fun fact: the director wanted Catherine Zeta-Jones to cut her hair, to have long hair.
Oh,
but she wanted it to be in a bob so that there was no shots where like her hair covered her face, and there could be no doubt that she was doing everything, because she was like she'd always been like this triple threat, and like had never had a showcase to do it. And she was like, when she got this, she was like, "There is, I wouldn't want anyone in the world to say like, oh, I bet that's not,
that's
I bet
a double.
That no one isn't her. It's a double."
Oh my
and
god!
And she was like, "Give me a bob and give me the lights." Oh, I love it so much.
This is my sub obsession with Chicago, which is the press tour around Chicago at the time, because I was, you know, 12, 13 when that came out, and just that's the time in your life when you're really watching the most TV.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, there's nothing to do. We've talked about this a lot, but like, what do you do? You can go to the soup, like the terrible shopping center that you're near, that you live near, and get
on Saturday
one item
as a treat.
Yeah,
but you've the rest
five
of the time,
pounds.
It's you and the TV, man.
It's you and the TV.
And I just remember the Oscar campaign for Chicago so well, where like every TV spot on Sky One was like, they worked so hard to make this musical, to the extent where like,
I love that was their main selling point. Please come.
They worked so hard.
They tried, man.
I just, there's certain images from that, and me and my friend Lo, who I know will be listening, it's like we worked together 9 years ago, and our first private joke was they worked so hard on that musical, and they wouldn't stop telling it. It's like these images of like Catherine Zeta-Jones in a practice leotard, mm-hmm. Just like, you know, with grainy footage in a rehearsal room with the chairs and all that kind of stuff, and Richard Gere learning to tap dance.
Yes, he learned to tap dance. It was like 3 months of like tap.
Tap.
I think it was like so, because I think sometimes you can be like, oh, star casting. But I think for this movie, it was so correct to go like, it had to be huge celebrities, I think. Because I just don't know that it would have worked with smaller people. Because it's just something about like, the fact that this is all about an industry where everyone wants to be famous. Like the whole thing of like, nothing matters except being famous. Like having your name in the papers. And to be, and for that to be the kind of in-joke of like, yeah, and here they are. Here, like, this is who you want to do this. You want Richard Gere dancing for your enjoyment. Because if it's some fucking guy, that's not Chicago, man. That's not it. And they audition like for the role of Roxy. I think it was like Madonna was going to play it originally.
Oh, wow.
Like a Jennifer Aniston audition. Like so many top actresses wanted to do it, but it's just like, ugh.
There's such a kind of fly in amber moment that happens when watching Chicago as well, because these are like three unbelievably talented leads, and also John C. Reilly and like Taye Diggs and Queen Latifah. It's all every single fucking person,
and they're all exquisite in every moment.
And they're all exquisite in every moment, and that's also what nothing moves me more than people who are trying their best.
Mm.
And that it really stirs.
Long time fan of trying our best.
Long time, yeah.
Huge
and
fan.
That's why even if I go to a bad musical. Present company not included.
Thank you. No, I'm not talking from personal experience. You can imagine.
But I always cry at the bows, because I'm just like, they really tried
they
their
really
best.
Tried.
And that it does feel like all these people who are inspired by the hard work they're seeing around them, not just by their co-stars, but the dancers, the musicians, the director, that everyone is just really, you can feel them working to get this over the line, because a successful movie musical hasn't been made in so long. But there's also this kind of tragedy of the fly in amber of like, none of those actors really got that, apart from Renee Zellweger, who did Judy and got an Oscar for it, but I didn't really like that movie. I just sort of respect it archly.
Yeah, it's such a difference, isn't it?
It's a difference, you
so,
know?
So clever.
They never really got that showcase again.
Yeah, that's so true.
We never put them in musical again.
Yeah.
Richard Gere has been banned from China, so he can't be in films anymore, which is a true thing.
Well, why is he banned from China?
Well, because he's a really outspoken supporter of Tibet, and so he's not put in any big movies anymore. This is real. Because
they can't get the Chinese like market to come see it. Fuck.
Yeah,
God.
Literally, the Chinese censors won't let new films with Richard Gere in. So big studios are a bit like, we can't sell this film in China, so why would we cast Gere?
Well, you know what? If he's had his run, he's got
he's still given us some perfection,
smashes over, you know? Over that time. But that is yeah, horrifying.
And then I think Renee and Catherine were just, I don't know, maybe they...
Well, maybe they just got a bit older as well. Like, that's terrible to say, obviously, but, like, you know, it's not easy to do all that stuff. Like, it's loads of dancing, and it's, you know, as someone who's now having to... I mean, I have to do very little dancing, really, but it's incredibly difficult. I love my job. It's incredibly difficult. I think also, I read an interview with Catherine Zeta-Jones where she talked about getting this part, and like she said, like even at the time, this is the once in a lifetime role of like where it's all going to come together for me. Because like, you know, to be Catherine Zeta-Jones and be incredibly famous and beautiful and to be a dancer and a singer at the same time, and like no one knew that somehow. Like she became this huge, she was hugely famous, and yet this role hadn't come up for her and did not come up for her again. Like, I mean, it's just like she just didn't want it after that, but like it's hard to envisage. And that's the thing about like when you achieve perfection as you do with Chicago,
where do you go from there?
Where do you go? Well, what's amazing is that it was the first feature movie that Rob Marshall had ever directed.
Yes.
And
say the thing,
because we
say
talk about this all the time. He also choreographed the movie.
Yeah, the director was the
director was the choreographer.
For listeners, me and Tasha have watched this film a few times together, and every time she says it's because the director was the choreographer.
It's true.
It's become a bit of a private joke in our circles.
It's just so beautiful. I'm so glad that we're
committing it to record.
Part, you know, for the people, but like. So that's like amazing for like six different reasons. Like, first of all, the idea that this is his first directorial feature debut. Like, imagine you've never directed, and then suddenly it's like you can audition anyone in the entire world for this movie, but if you fuck it up, you are done. Like, that is it for you. Like, he, to be fair, like, I'm sure you're about stage. Like, he had lots of stage credits, and he had directed Kander and Ebb, who wrote Chicago and also wrote Cabaret and wrote a few different musicals, including one called Kiss of the Spider Woman, which I also recommend checking out because it's great. And he'd done some work. I think he directed Kiss of the Spider Woman, and like, so he was very familiar with musical world. But like, the difference of that and like, and having to suddenly have this corral, this army. But I do think there's something about like, as you said before, about like everyone working hard and trying their best. There's something about musical theatre where there are so many people that need to be on the top of their game for it to be good. Like, it's not like, even because I'd written plays and put on plays before in the past. Again, with the same people.
To your credit, plays with music in them.
Plays music in them, for sure. And like, you know, I've done other types of writing. But like, I've never experienced the kind of trust and faith that you have to have in so many different people in order for the thing to actually work. Suddenly it's like, sound design, if you don't have amazing sound design, your musical won't work. It just, there's nothing. If lighting design, if your lighting is crap, it doesn't work. Like, the costume, the set design, the direction, the choreographer, like, it's I know it's kind of an obvious thing to say, but like, it's the most collaborative medium I've ever experienced. And that is like both beautiful and joyous. And I think is the reason that why people end up with marketing campaigns like, they've all worked so hard. because it's just like nothing, like you can't really, I mean, maybe you can, but you can't really be like a maniacal, I think, like a director or an auteur in that medium and have the same sort of success, because it relies so heavily on so many different skills and so many different talents. And that's even before you've like cast people, and they have to sing it beautifully, and they have to dance it, and they have to act it, and it all has to work together, which again is just like, to get all of that in this movie, it's just like, for a guy who's never even directed a movie before to take on that challenge and absolutely smash it out of the park. Like, every time I can't watch the Cell Block Tango without just feeling like, this is the peak of humans'
creativity,
ability.
Yeah.
Like, it just goes up and up and up. It's like every single, again, you can tell it's from musicals, but like that sequence, every time that you're used to how beautiful something is, like a sequence is, they add, like he drops that back wall and all of the women are lit up in the back, and it's just like, you feel like you've been turned inside out by that point. It is crazy. And like, as soon as that, you've got used to that, they're sort of through the bars, and then they've got an amazing dance sequence with all of them on the ground, and like then you're in among the dancers. Because I think that's what's amazing about the film medium, is like it pays such beautiful homage to like what the stage spectacle of a backdrop dropping and being like, I am now in an audience of a theatre. That you get that buzz. But then on top of that, he goes, yeah, but what if you could see every sinew? What if you could like watch that light pass that dancer's neck as it's flowing, which you don't get as on a stage. It's like you get both like the show and the backstage pass of the show in the same sequence. It's just
so, and also you have that other layer on top of it, and we've kind of skipped a Celibac Tango, but we will hit When You're Good to Mama, because you can't not. I'm just looking at the chronological track order, but
oh yeah, so just to do the track order, so you've got
all that jazz,
which was the reason that actually Catherine Zeta-Jones wanted to play Velma Kelly, only because she knew that Velma Kelly got All That Jazz, and that was the song she wanted to sing. Even though technically, like,
which is such Velma Kelly reasoning.
I know. I love how like, oh, that's just like the idea that Catherine Zeta-Jones is like, I'll only do it if I can do All That Jazz. And like, oh, of course, the person who says that has to play Velma Kelly.
And just the ending that whole number. Oh, I'm no one's wife.
And the police are coming in. Oh, la la la. And, like, you've got the direct, like, the fucking guy with the badge staring at her. They're taking her to prison that night. And she's
like, let her finish the number.
Yeah, they do. She's Velma Kelly. You get Velma Kelly to finish the number. Oh, my God.
And that sort of like that beautiful storytelling, that beautiful threading of like, I think the only real lines you get out of Renee Zellweger in that whole thing is like, oh, I thought we were going to see about your friend. Or like the thing of like, she's been, Fred Casely has promised.
I think it's that. And right at the end, she's like, tell it again, Fred. She's like, you're going to be a star, kid. You're going to be a star. It's like, that's her actual orgasm. It's just a man saying to her, you're going to be a star.
A furniture salesman. With five little Casely's at home.
All That Jazz, absolutely incredible.
Perfect.
Sets everyone up. Like, you know, having now written actually four openings for the musical that we've done, and like hopefully having finished now writing an opener. Writing a good opening for a musical is so hard, and like all the jobs that you have to do. Admittedly, mine is particularly difficult because you're also trying to go, what's happening in a huge war?
Yes.
Loads of detail.
Operation Mincemeat, set in World War II.
It's set in World War II. We can maybe talk more about that. It's come out of realm, but yeah, it's set in World War II. It's a sort of spy caper set in World War II. Very funny. Trying to get to the end of that first number with everyone feeling like we've got our key characters, we've got our sort of impetus, we know what the premise is, like we know we're going on from here, so that you can land into your sort of I Want song with all of that done. So you're not trying to do a bunch of other stuff with your I Want song, which kind of what you want your I Want song to do is to kind of make your audience go, I care about this person. I want to follow their story. Please, let's go on the next thing, which is what Roxy, obviously.
Well, Roxy is until a bit later on. Roxy
what
actually happens
next?
And is Funny Honey.
Is that, oh, of course, because of Amos.
It's when she's like trying to... which is the other thing that I love about Chicago so much. Like when you're watching a bad musical or musicals that make me feel really cold is when the they're singing and I'm looking at the thing.
Yes.
They're singing about going to the big city and I'm watching them walk on the pretend moving walkway holding a briefcase like the shirt coming out of it, like ha, and this mom is kissing him goodbye.
Last call to the new city.
It's like, what's the point? What's the point of having ears and eyes if they're both looking at the same thing? Do you know what I mean? And Chicago has this great thing of like servicing you this song that's telling you one thing, but you're looking at totally another. And that's a great thing of Roxy's imagination. And it's the first time we're really meeting Roxy. And it's like her singing about how much she loves her husband while she's framing him. And then he's not even like smart enough to get away with taking the fall for his wife's murder.
We've not really talked about the fact that it's based on a true story. And it's based on, it's not that they don't, it's based on two murderesses. Chicago's actually based on a play, and the same woman who wrote the play was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, I think, and she was investigating the spate of sort of murderesses in the 1920s, and the woman who's unfortunately name I can't recall, but who's based on Roxy Hart, really did get her dear husband to pay for her entire court proceedings and then divorced him the next day.
Oh.
So it's just like, it's all true.
And also employed a both reaching for the gun defense. You know? And this is the thing. It's like you can, this, the journalistic frame stays on the entire movie, right?
Well, exactly. And that's why, like, yeah, the character of Mary...
Mary Sunshine.
Mary Sunshine is
Christine,
like...
Christine Baranski.
What? I mean, she's a joy. She's a joy in everything she does. but yeah, the woman who wrote the play basically based Mary... was like
Hedda Hopper.
Based it on her, the Mary character, Mary Sunshine, on herself and her role in that, in the whole thing of like... And yeah, and like, because it's a whole musical, it's a movie about people wanting attention and wanting to get their name in the papers, you know, and like the final line of the whole movie is Roxy and Velma shouting, you know, thank you so much. We could not have done this without you. And it's just like the whole, it's the whole symbiosis between the press and the crimes and Chicago. And like, and it feels like, sort of gone off a bit here, but like it feels every time we watch it, and we said this before, like it's still completely true. It's still that thing of like this, how much press can be whipped up, and like how much can that be used to your advantage, and how much is it, and how can the press turn on you, and like who's in control here, like who runs this circus, who runs the old razzle dazzle,
and it remains this like incredibly true parable, and this whole idea of like murder as entertainment has become like. Like, we're in the 20s again. Yeah. We're literally in the 20s, and our interests are still there. Like, people fucking chaining murder podcasts, like, it's going out of style. Like, you could see it happening again in the 2020s. And, like, and it's this fascinating thing of, like, you know, if you think of Roxy, of that song, and the denouement of that song being like, and they love them for loving me, and
I love them, they just gonna love my childhood.
Yeah, and this realization that Roxy, what she wants, her I want, is fame above all else, and that's how she began, even before she was a murderer, that was everything that she wanted. And this idea, this fake idea that people go into fame with, people who crave fame, which is that attention will save you.
Yes.
And in Chicago, and in many real cases, I imagine, fame does save you, attention does save you, and people caring does save you. And the having a mouthpiece saves you, having someone who will speak for you, like someone like Billy Flint, to literally speak for you and who's respectable, will save you. And then in the center of it, we have this like very camp, outsized film where everyone's an anti-hero and no one's sympathetic. There's this tiny like kernel of the Hungarian woman who dies.
Ugh, in the cell block tango.
In the cell block tango. Not guilty! And it like, it gets me more and more every time, I think. I always found it as a teenager sort of elegant and beautiful, and the idea of her as ballerina and the sort of vanishing act kind of thing, I found it just very cool. But like, I think the older you get and the more you learn about how the world actually works, you're like, oh yeah, people who, immigrants can't represent themselves, and people who can't speak English can't represent themselves, and those who can't get representation die or fall through the cracks.
I think that's done so incredibly well. And again, like one of the reasons that I feel like it's so important that it is a movie and not just a musical, which is kind of a weird thing to say, is like the managing to like have the juxtaposition of the amazing ballerina act and the horrible trudge that you watch her go up to the gallows, and her, like, you see how lumpy her socks are even. And it's like a horrible day, and like they've obviously purposefully done it so it's maximum sort of traumatic to watch, but kind of goes, this is, but you need to see the difference between the sparkly world of this, of what we all want to escape into, and what actually happens as a result of our fixation with just glitz and glamour and beauty.
And it's this incredible sort of reminder of the stakes as well, which is something, if you've ever written any kind of story for anyone with a musical or novel or whatever, the most annoying note you'll ever get is, but the stakes don't feel high enough.
I was like, well, she's dead.
She's dead.
It's not enough for you. And I think also, like, in terms of like small glimmers of humanity, like, and again, we're sort of not really going by the song list, but I think Mr. Cellophane and the character of Amos, which the fact that it is like based on a real guy and like a genuine husband, like that must have been a really good impetus to come out. No, this is true. This is the truth. This is what happened. This guy puts everything into this murderess.
Yeah.
And at the end, she fakes a pregnancy, gets off scot-free, and then he dumps her. But I think it could easily be like a kind of a forgettable number, you know, as is almost the point of Mr. Cellophane. But I think everyone knows it. Everyone remembers that kind of tiny port in the storm of the whole move, which is just like this solid man with his little clown makeup on.
I know.
Human beings made in more than air.
And it's so. But like, I feel like if you were like, there's the opportunity there. You could have made his story happier. You could have seen maybe see Amos at the end of the story, and maybe he's going off to a better life. But you don't see any of that. It's just like good characters get no redemption.
Yes.
Good characters, good things do not happen to good people. And it's amazing because there are very few musicals. I can't really think of any others that are like huge family favorites and like famous, where good people don't win. The baddies, you root for the bad guys the whole way through, and you come out still feeling like a million bucks because you're like, wow, I had a great time. And it's just really, it's really interesting that like how, yeah, why anyone sort of thought that this story would work as a musical when like the whole kind of premise of going to see a musical is to come and go in and come out feeling lighter and brighter about the world. And you still do, but it's through the pure power of entertainment. And like, because the songs and the craft are so gorgeous and it's funny and it's dark and it's spooky and it's like, and all of that is more important ultimately when you're viewing it than being like, yeah, but do we like Velma Kelly?
Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And it's there's so much like quite boring conversation about like likable female characters.
Oh God, yes.
And everybody thinks that because they like, you know, they'll have a character who's like a bit catty once to their best friend in the sitcom.
Give her a side eye.
Like, she's a flawed female character. She's messy.
She's so messy. I love it.
But it's like, this is mess. This is fucking, this is a couple of bitches.
Clawing their way out of hell, or just like pushing each other's faces down into the dirt. But yeah, and yet, like, I feel like, again, because it's just a testament to how well it's made, when Velma Kelly has to come to Roxy and you get Can't Do It Alone, and like the power dynamics shifted so much by this point, Roxy is the fucking hot shit, and Velma kind of slinks over to her with some chocolates.
Yeah, bonbons.
And you just. And Roxy's just like, I'm watching my figure. It's just like, oh, they're so horrible to them. But like, you feel for them. But
when she's scrapbooking, she's like, yeah. Oh, you got a little,
keep up.
You got a mention right next to the obituaries. And it's like quite literally like one of the, they could die.
Yeah.
And there's no remorse, no friendship, no nothing. I feel like we've skipped over When You're Good to Mella, and I really like
Sorry,
to go back to
let's
it.
Let's go back to it. No, absolutely.
It's not even that I have anything specific to say. It's just my favorite.
Is it your favorite? Is it favorite in the show?
I think it could be my favorite in the show. I think, I don't know, there's something just so...
I think the performance version of it is like, as in like the, when you cut to Queen Latifah, like doing the performance version, it's so exquisite and she looks absolutely amazing. Yeah. And there's quite a lot of like, maybe more than the other songs, like quite a lot of like audience interaction that she has with like the people at the club.
Yes.
And it just kind of like, you just get that sense of like, they are having the best night of their entire lives, those people.
The greatest show on earth.
The greatest show on earth. And then you could, and that is completely endlessly interspliced with just like, you know, getting a pack of cigarettes and slipping in a girl's garter and being like, that is the, you know, in terms of realities, that is the same glamorous as this enormous show. Like, because in, you know, when you're in prison, it's kind of like, oh my God, I've got a fucking pack of cigarettes and managed to do it. Like, the sort of switch of power is just so delicious.
And if you think of, like, you don't really get that much screen time with Queen Latifah apart from that song.
No.
And, like, she is a facilitator. She's the person who, like, puts in the phone calls for you or whatever. But even so, there's still so much mystery to that character that I find so tantalizing. Mm. Like, is she gay? I think so, but not...
Yeah, it's like, not... Yeah, again, it's just like... It's not ostensibly. You won't see her on the screen, yeah. But surely.
She feels gay.
She feels gay.
But in a way that's mostly about exploiting people.
Yeah. It's sort of just like, sort of like lesbian power. Sort
yeah.
Of, yeah, yeah. But yeah, I don't know. But she, I think also because like in the musical version, she has another song.
Class.
She has Class with Velma. So maybe it's like in the stage version, you maybe like get a bit more. But even then it's like, but you don't need it. Like, I don't feel
I like the mystery
for that
sitting where it is, yeah. You know? And this thing of like, the folks atop the ladder are the ones the world adores, so boost me up my ladder, kid, and I'll boost you up yours. I'm not going to sing in front of you because you do it for a living.
It's an audition. I'm thinking about it. I'll take you to the producers. We'll see.
And like just this notion that like, you know, you don't... Everybody is on the make and on the take mm-hmm. in this movie, apart from Amos, who obviously is screwed over by the narrative. And I know we've said it already, but it just... I love that.
I think also, like, I think it's just a really good example of, like, a song where, like, you set out the thing. It's a classic realm song, you know? So it's like, you set out the thing at the top, which is, like, this is going to be a song about you helping me, helping you. Mm. And so then they just have, like, the really fun time with all, like, just the images of me, like, you know, the stroke and the, you know, they're in their canoe.
Stroke together, like, the Prince and Crew.
You know, exactly. And just being, like, it's just such a luxurious song. Like, it's just such a joy.
Yeah.
Because you're, like... You don't have to, you know, again, the thing with like a corridor song or whatever you want to call it is like, you kind of have to think quite a lot. You're like, okay, so we're here and then that's information I'm going to have to retain in that character's. Whereas this is just like, it's just you and Queen Latifah. It's just like blood and spreading butter on toast and eating it on down.
Oh,
it's just like,
just let it melt.
Just watch it like in the hands of a fucking master. And also I think you get the impression that like, she's not going to be like an important plot character. This is her moment.
Mm.
And so it's just like, she just eats it up.
She fucking eats it.
Eats it up. And it's just miraculous. And what a great part. Like, I just feel like it's a bit like, kind of like the king in Hamilton. It's kind of like,
yes.
You don't have too much to do.
Get out.
You get in, you fucking barnstorm the house down. Everyone loves you. And it's like,
everyone's talking about
in the
interlude.
Back.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas Roxy and Velma, it's like, you gotta dance for the fucking whole show.
Yeah. I would like us next to talk about We Both Reach for the Gun.
I think when I saw it when I was little, this was the sequence that made me lose my whole mind. I just couldn't believe what I was watching. I think because, like, maybe this is the one, in terms of what it looks like, it's the most sort of theatrical. Like, you cut to that stage version where they're all sort of ventriloquist dummies and, like, there's a lot of sort of chair work. So much chair work. Because actually, in the film version, in the kind of reality version, you're just in that one place. You're on that one journalist stand. You know, Billy Flynn is doing a press conference with Roxy and she needs to toe the line and she's not doing it, so she's, you know, he's going to speak for her. And so it's like a beautiful, clean setup. Ventriloquist dummy, great, yum, we're in. But actually, the majority of the action happens in the kind of stage world version, where all suddenly you get like all the dancers look amazing and like the choreography is just incredible, and you have all this kind of like flighty work with all the kind of wires and stuff.
And it's another backdrop going up and revealing more of the press.
Yes,
and
so true. Just can't beat a like big reveal. I feel like he like this Rob Marshall, what he realized was that you can get across that feeling, that stage feeling, because I feel like there's a lot of, you know, you'd be tempted to be like, well, you can't have the feeling of, oh my god, now there's 50 of them in quite the same way if it's a movie. But actually, if you're smart, you absolutely can. And also you get to do that, the kind of the juxtaposition of like real world, fake world, us, just because it makes everything into a music video, because you have all the quick cuts back and forth. So you get that constant dopamine hit, like you when you're sort of 13 watching MTV, of just like, this is the most exciting thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, I'd love to know how many cuts there were all over that movie. It'd just be like millions. But it makes it so exciting.
It's so
exciting.
That's
the reason it works.
I do really believe that there are, if you're a millennial, that you were one of two kinds of teenage girls, which was, you were a Cell Block Tango girl or you were a Both Before the Gun girl.
That's so true. Oh my god.
my God. It's so true.
You were either like choreographing little girl group numbers and having a great time with your like big gang of mm-hmm. girlfriends. And all that kind of stuff. Or
you were meticulously learning the difference of the yes, they both
reach for the gun.
No, yes, they both reach for the gun. Nice to meet you. Hi, we know who we are. Write us in. Which time were you? No shame in not being.
No shame. Both
beautiful,
valid
types of girl. Absolutely.
The only horoscope I'm interested in were. It's gonna be some girls like writing in now, being like, "I was more of a razzle dazzle girl."
Oh, I mean, I just don't trust a razzle dazzle girl. That's weird. Although I do get something that it's a
razzle dazzle is a pick me girl. it's the sweaty palmed loner energy.
Act one in the show ends with "I just can't do it alone," which is just an absolute. Stormer from Roxy Mama, because it's interesting, like it's what you have to think about when you turn I imagine I'm not done adaptation just yet, but obviously when it's a traditional stage musical, your end of act one closer has to be an absolute firestormer. But also, generally speaking, act ones are much longer than act twos. Generally speaking, act one is an hour and a half ish and then act two would be 45 minutes, and so it makes like plotting the movie version quite complicated. I know for a fact, for instance, that they've and vice versa. So they're doing Wicked. They're adapting Wicked for a film at the moment.
Oh yes.
And I don't know how much you know about Wicked, but it ends.
I've seen it.
Have you seen it? So it ends with Defying Gravity,
of course.
Like create like the big number, but like actually in terms of like plot arc, it happens in quite an annoying place for your story, because like that's like an hour and a half of story has to have passed by for you to get to Defying Gravity, and then a whole new stuff happens. And so I think they've announced recently that it's actually going to be two films.
What?
I know.
That's so dumb. Isn't so Ariana Grande thingy?
Yeah, Elphaba.
Yeah.
Elphaba? Ariana? Oh, I don't know. I mean, she might be playing. I can't remember which one she's playing. But yeah, because it's kind of weird, lumpy plotting. It's like, it's similarly with, so Frozen obviously was a movie first and then was adapted into a stage musical.
Any use as a stage show?
I've not seen it, but I'm too poor to go watch it. If you're listening as a Frozen, I'd love to come and see it, but it's meant to be absolutely like spectacle wise amazing. But the kind of central question about it was, because the huge number in Frozen is Let It Go, but actually that song happens pretty early on in the movie. It happens like 20 minutes in or whatever. It's like, hey, she's free. She lives in a mountain now. Mm-hmm. Bye. But like, they could not have had that stage musical not end act one without that number. So apparently what they've had to do is like fill loads of extra story. Like, what about life around the castle? What's going on with these villagers? Let's do a song about that. Just so that you can engineer like that song for your end of act one.
Oh, it's so interesting. And why is it that like I understand like why the end of act one has to sort of end on your best song or your most memorable song, really. Is it because you're afraid that people are going to just fuck off?
Yeah, I guess so. I think we want people to
not
go
come back
the
from
interval
the fact
being like, I want to drink and talk and stay in this world forever, because they're like, it's not that many art forms where you let people out halfway through and give them an option as to whether you want to go back in. Like, no one wants to be given that option and be like, I'll go. That's fine.
Enough for me, thank you.
It's enough for me. So I think, the end of act one number is like hugely, hugely important. And I can see why in Chicago, what they do with it is like...
Well the second half is the court case.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it just gives you everything you want.
It gives you what you want!
But it sort of puts, I simply can't do it, cannot do it alone, just sort of gives a huge, big stage dance vaudeville number to your main dancer, which is Thelma Kelly, and letting her just completely fly free.
So
but I think in the musical version, I don't know whether Roxy is slightly more involved. Obviously in the film she just sits in a chair looking
unimpressed,
like a bitch.
I always love that little fart noise she makes with her mouth.
Yeah.
it's quite airy. It's a very airy fart.
It is. Delicate little jewel sound.
It's like the thing is, the non-singing moments in Chicago feel like singing, because there's like something Janina said on our Titanic episode, which was the thing that modern blockbuster filmmakers lose and the Christopher Nolan effect on mainstream movies is they forget that you should leave a cinema wanting to say things.
Wanting to say things.
Yeah, you want to leave Titanic saying, I'll put the diamond in the coat and I'll put the coat on her. Like, it's such like fun bits and like just like slightly kind of camp ways of saying quite ordinary lines. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many like tiny line deliveries I remember in Chicago that make me want to say the things. Like, there's this bit where in I Can't Do It Alone where Velma's calling after Roxy and she goes, why? And he goes, because I hate you.
Because I hate you.
I think also that is probably like inherited from the fact that like in musicals, whenever you're not singing, it kind of feels like the audience is there being like, yeah, well, can you get to a song?
Yeah.
So you're like, you have to be so efficient with your dialogue because ultimately you get so used to that like roller coaster of like this orchestra, you know, with start and we're doing a song, we're doing a song, and we're ending the song, applause, and you go pow with loads of pace and energy into your next scene. But the kind of return on that is like they'll be like, when's the next one? Come on.
When's the next one?
So many lines, like if you have a lot of information, or even if you don't, you just want to do some character time in your scenes, your lines have to be like so sharp and pithy and like say the most you can in the fewest possible lines, because everyone's there being like, no matter how good this is, it's not singing.
It's not singing, is it?
It's not singing. Why aren't you singing this? We used to do singing now. But yeah, it's like a thing that we came across like a lot when writing this music, or the Operation Mincemeat, is just like, because we are used to writing plays and like that's all dialogue and it's all like, we'll do a little like, you know, sub layer into a little joke. Oh, we'll do some jokes over here and we'll do some jokes over there and come out, you're being like, this script is really, it's really zingy, it's really great. And then you put it on stage in a musical and suddenly you feel so quickly the kind of weight, the dead weight of like fun little bits.
So true.
And in a way that you wouldn't if it was a play, because it's all fun little bits and that's great, but like you can feel the audience being like, what are you doing?
Wait, who is this for? It's
like,
so true.
What's going on?
And it's where like physical non-speaking bits really come into their own. The bit I think about, I actually said this to you on the way here, the bit in your musical that, as I said to you, makes me feel like a baby. There's just a bit, it's like this, it's almost like it's something from a silent movie where it's like a character passing, two characters passing a phone and a hat to each other for maybe 3 minutes.
A phone, a hat and a briefcase.
Don't
forget the briefcase.
And I feel
it's
like
a classic bit of farce.
A 6-month-old in a high chair being fed with a spoon that's a plane, and I believe it's a plane. And like those moments, and it's weird because I'm writing quite a lot of scripts now, and the first draft is always just people standing around talking in rooms forever. And then with each subsequent draft, physical sort of things stand in for words, and you trim, that's how my process seems to be anyway, you just trim out more and more words. And like there's like bits in Chicago, like for example when Billy Flint is deciding whether to take Amos's case, I can imagine that first draft was like a long dialogue scene, but instead it's just him turning around in his chair and then him turning back around and putting his hand on the little stack of money. He's like, I will take your
words. It's almost embarrassing how, as writers, to be like, you want to be like, I'm sorry, the audience will not understand this nuance unless we put in this monologue about how much she loves beans. Like, the beans are so much.
Fork to eat her beans.
How will the fork dynasty begin if we haven't set out the bean conundrum?
Yeah.
And actually, someone just goes, yeah, but what if he just sort of went over to the door and turned back? Like, and you're like, that's 5 pages of dialogue.
Just lost.
You just don't need it. You just, and it is like...
binned.
And it's, I think what's really great about, again, sort of like doing on stage is that, well, first of all, you get to, if you're writing a stage thing and you're putting it on, you get to change it every night. And like, so if it's the first time you've done it, you'll be like, great, 5 pages of dialogue, we did it, everyone was cross. Fine. Okay, 4 pages of dialogue, with everyone still cross. 3 pages of dialogue, and then suddenly you hit the sweet spot and it's like, oh, it was a look, oh my God.
It was just
and
a look.
Having that ability to test it and change it and like remold it, which I imagine for you, you know, you write, your majority writing books, and it's like, that can't change. Is that weird?
Yeah. It is weird. What's the weirdest thing is that like the change is in a book, which I generally write from a first person perspective. It's like people can just have their thoughts for days.
They thought enough?
They just have a thought for ages. Someone says something and they think about that for ages as well. And then maybe they go somewhere else and have a sandwich. You know what I mean?
Chapter four.
And then you change it to sort of a visual medium and suddenly gestures and things that they physically do with their bodies have to stand in for thoughts.
Yeah, that's so true. You can't like narrate.
Yeah, and that has been the steepest climb for me as an artist.
But yeah, I imagine because obviously Chicago was first a play and then a musical and now it's movie version, it must have had so much like rigorous like training on audiences and like for years and years and years until it was just like there was just nothing. Nothing left. Stop sliding that money into the... It's so good. It's a pile of money on the table and he just puts it money. All into it. He doesn't count it. He just like slides it all messily into the drawer and closes the drawer.
What do you think about Lucy Liu's weird cameo in this movie?
Oh my God, that's such a great question. I mean, I love it. I think it's fantastic.
I love it too, but it's the one part where I don't understand why it's there a bit. I do understand why it's there.
You don't know why it's there or why it's Lucy Liu?
Yeah, I think it's why it's Lucy Liu is a big part of it because she was such a big name and you're kind of waiting for her to do something and all she does like kick somebody and we never see her again
in a bra in a lovely
kick
bra.
Somebody in a lovely bra.
Yeah, you're right in that like you could almost slide out that whole sequence and it wouldn't make any difference. But I think what it does really nicely is that because you're cutting, as I recall, you're cutting back and forth between Billy Flynn telling the story of it in a kind of cabaret bar with loads of people laughing. Ha ha ha, it's really funny. And then you're watching it fall out for real. Mm-hmm. And there's the kind of, what I always remember about that is like how harrowing the kind of the jump between Billy Flynn with his cigar and it's like, he's in like a golden, and like everyone's like, huh. And like he does the dialogue.
Yes,
the murder,
yes.
And then you sort of see them do it like with no audio in like their real flat where she's pointing the gun at the husband and there's two lovers and like, and it's so horrible and you can see they're genuinely pleading for their lives.
Yeah.
It's like she's tears down her face and she pulls the trigger, but you just cutting back and forth between it, like the act and the story of it. Like the act and the story of the act, like how the horrible thing that's happened and how it will be told. And like that encapsulation of the whole, again, the whole thing, which is like
murder is entertainment.
It's just like a bit. It's just like a beautiful kind of sequence that's just kind of like, if it's almost like kind of like if you wanted to do a pilot of this musical, it would just be like just that. It's the idea of glamorous murder, horrible, and then how it's going to get told to the people.
And then this great thing of like it diverting attention away from Roxy. And
yes.
And it's the thing that like puts her in line because at that point she's like become a diva.
She's a little big
for
old boots.
I hope it doesn't hurt the baby. So good.
Just, you go to the gallery and she's shit.
I love that. I love the whole baby thing because it's like you're just so used to so much sort of like preciousness around sort of femaleness and pregnancy.
Oh yeah,
and
that's so true.
The idea that it would be something you'd come up with just in the spur of the moment to get a bit of attention is so fun to me.
I think like possibly one of the reasons that we particularly chime so much with Chicago is because it's a perfect piece of art, but also just like celebration of women being kind of stupid and weird and cruel and mean. I kind of feel like we're so sick of nice women who are brave and smart.
I know, I hate them.
Those brave, smart bitches.
I don't want women lifting each other up.
I don't want to tear them down. Fake the pregnancies. Murder the fucking lover. Like, I think that, like, ongoing, I feel like there's not enough, maybe, attention paid for the fact that, like, it is just such a great homage to women not having to ask for permission to be interesting. You know what I mean? Just being like, what's her redeeming? There isn't one. She's
no
interesting person.
And it's such an important part of the opening bars of Cell Block Tango. It's so important that the first murder in that song is the guy chews and pops his gum too much.
Popping it.
Or is it the first one?
What's the thing that... it could very easily... Like, that song could so easily be women who were put upon
beaten,
and beaten and abused... And like they absolutely deserve, you know. And we could be on, but like, what's amazing is you hear their reasons; they are nothing, and yet you're still just like, yeah, it's coming.
It was a murder, but not a crime.
Just like because you get this sense of like the years. I think maybe this is getting too deep into it, but like the years of accumulated shit that these women have put up with. That even like they don't have, and like kind of
separately
like,
mean nothing.
Separately mean nothing, but together it's like it's hard, man. Sometimes you want to stab
a
guy.
You've been screwing the milkman, he said.
He kept on screaming. You've been screwing the milkman. It's just like, there is like an oddly primitive, like primal release in that song that I think is one of the reasons it's like one of the most sort of famous songs in it, which is just like, there's not one reason. It is a million tiny reasons. Mm. And the reason that you watch that and it's just so delicious is because you're kind of going, yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. One of those Mormons, you know?
One of those Mormons, you know?
We are running out of time.
We've not even got to act two.
10 to 2. We got it at half 12.
But we could listen for... We could listen, talk about it forever.
Talk forever. I mean, no one's kicking us out, so I guess we just keep talking.
Have we actually been talking for that long?
Yeah, we have.
They had it coming,
they
though.
They had it coming! All right, we gotta go to... I mean, do you have anything to say about the courtroom representation? Because I think that is the most dialogue that we get in the whole movie.
Is it before Razzle Dazzle?
Oh, no, yeah. Razzle Dazzle comes first and then the courtroom, yeah.
So hang on, Razzle Dazzle comes first and then the courtroom.
So we get the Lucy Liu bit and then she's been cowed because she's realised she's been a diva and now she's terrified.
Now she's wearing the horrible dress.
She's wearing the horrible dress. She's seen an innocent Hungarian woman get murdered mm-hmm. and Lucy Liu kick a photographer and put the wind up her.
As it would.
As it would. And she's like, Billy, I'm nervous. And he's like, nah, it's a circus. It's don't worry.
And then then they open the door and then it goes into Razzle Dazzle. I actually think, for my money... Razzle Dazzle is not a very interesting song.
No.
But I think the way that it's presented in the film makes it one of the great sequences in the movie.
What would we call that room or corridor?
Such a good question. I would say as audio, it is absolutely room.
Mm.
But in the presentation of the... Because, we start at the end of the... Because, to be fair, we begin the song, her walking to the courtroom, and it ends with her taking the stand.
Yeah.
So really, it's sort of still a room song, isn't it? But you get a sense of stuff happening and time passing.
Yeah.
Because I think it's like one of the only times in the movie that the two worlds completely combine. I remember like the physical like goosebumps I got when, because you have like the shot of the jury and then like the shot of the jury as real and then the kind of cut to the fictional cabaret world and the dancers there. And then at certain moments in the song, the dancers come through the jury box in the real world. And like that meshing, the worlds kind of bleed properly the first time. It's kind of like, this is the culmination. This is what it's been leading towards. Now there's no difference between the performance and the performance.
Yes.
Like it's all performance.
The core is performance, yes.
And just being like completely electrified by like the fact that they... had been building that this entire time and like this is when they're gonna merge them. So yeah, I like it's the song that I would skip like when I used to listen to the
used to
the album. when I was like not cool, not like I am now. I would probably skip past Razzle Dazzle, but I do think it's like for absolute showpiece. And this is nice to just watch Richard. I mean, do you think he's better in All I Care About Is Love or Razzle Dazzle? In that movie.
Do I actually enjoy any of his songs for the songs themselves, I wonder?
Yeah. So that's what you gotta ask yourself.
That bit in All I Care About Is Love when he's like riding the chariot of women.
No. I think what I said, like one of their legs is like the handbrake.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
yes! The handbrake leg!
And again, I think again it's like it's so good as a movie because you get to see him in real life just being like a dick. Like he's in the tailor and they're not doing it properly and like he's just turning down cases left, right, and center because he's a prick. And then in the song, it's just like, all he cares about is love.
And this thing of like, this is somebody who has like built their reputation on defending women, who doesn't give a fuck about women.
Yeah.
He will ride them like a chariot to the
absolutely.
Top.
And every single one of his clients gets off because he's just so good. And it's all terrible. It's all so corrupt. And yet you're just like, yay.
And then we have the obviously, I think what I find so clever is the thing of in the courtroom itself when you have all these like, I think it's sort of implied it's over several days of presenting evidence and such. And
they must do their diligence, Caroline.
The bit with the diary.
A man has died.
Five little cases.
Five little cases.
But they have the, ladies and gentlemen, a tap dance. So you have this percussive beat that's going through all this sort of dialogue and bits.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Still musical theater sketting for those of
you. Yeah,
because it's like his closing argument or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like when he interviews
erroneous. Doesn't that sound like a word a lawyer might use?
Objection. Oh God. Is there anything more exciting than a courtroom scene?
Oh, planting a fake diary. And nothing more exciting than that.
Erroneous. Apparently, his tap dance took half a day to film, his little tap dance sequence. I feel like you don't really even see him.
That's an excerpt from They Tried So Hard, British campaign.
He tried so hard.
I'd love to get that PR girl in. Of course, she's a woman now.
She's a woman now.
I guess, I mean, we should probably close up with nowadays. But that bit where, it's the only time that we see Roxy actually performing as herself, a woman in the real world.
Oh my God, I'm like, it's just such a... Because it goes from her performing nowadays in like the fake spectacle world. And the spotlight slowly dims on her face, and she's like trying to stay in the spotlight, and it closes, and then you cut to her in a shitty club, essentially,
with not much range,
with not a lot of range, auditioning, and like her moves are so crap. Like she's not really dancing. She's like, "You can like the life you're living." and it's like that sense of like all this for that, and like she gets like three bars down her audition. And Tay Diggs is on the piano and he gives back her music. She's like, no, it's not. And like the audition people like run out of the room to get away from her. And it's just so nothing. It's like the most amazing anticlimax for all this business.
And this thing of like, you've been, because everything exists in Roxy Hart's head, you've been led to believe that, she's a horrible, selfish, murdering woman
but
who feels
surely.
No. But she's got talent and she needs, but actually, she doesn't have talent.
She doesn't. And it's that exact thing of being like, okay, if you stripped away everything, if you just had nothing but the music and the girl in the room, could she wow the people? And it's like, no. And then amazing, of course, like, and then Velma comes in and her stockings are all ripped because she's not getting the job she used to. And she's like, one murderer is nothing but two.
And then, I would see the show.
Oh, I would see the show. And also, like, because, like, then you're, like, in this beautiful, huge theater and, like, the backdrop is beautiful and their costumes are amazing. And it's suddenly, like, and that's what they need. Like, without the razzle-dazzle, without all of everything around it, it's nothing. It doesn't exist.
And everyone's there.
Everyone's there. Billy Flynn's clapping. And
Queen Latifah's clapping.
Everyone, yeah. And, like, you have that amazing kind of, like, juddery, strange camera where it's, like, flashes and it suddenly goes into almost, like, a drunken, surreal dream state just to kind of be, like, almost kind of, like, landing you out of this world that you've just been in. It's, like, kind of saying you have to, you know, it's goodbye to this place now and you don't want to leave
because
it's so beautiful. And you're, like, you know it's all nonsense. You know it's all pixie dust and yet you want to, like, you just want to stay there.
And they have the machine guns and the lights.
The machine guns? And it's like the music is so gorgeous and the orchestration is so gorgeous and they just, it's just the two of them just dancing, like there's no you know, it's in their gorgeous outfits and it's just like such a great celebration of just like them as artists, them as people, but also like it's just been for nothing and it's all just nonsense. It's just such a crazy cocktail of like you feel all of those things of like all that for this two-woman show. Yeah. And yet you are completely intoxicated. And you don't want it to end.
And you're like, they deserve this. I hope they take it worldwide.
Yeah.
I hope they get it in the talkies.
the frenzy of the crowd and being like, the passion.
You
of the,
just
like,
want that star to keep rising. Yeah. You don't want either of them to see a lick of justice.
Yeah, no. And it's just like, you know, that the craziness and the frenzy of it being like, this is what makes people stars. It's what makes people murderers. And it's kind of like, you need that fire, man. Like, it's almost that justification of like, this is passion. Passionate people kill people, and you kind of
passionate people kill people.
If you write a musical, you're gonna, you know,
and it's cool to be around.
And it's cool. Yeah, and it's kind of like it's that you kind of end on that thing of like if you can't have one without the other, like if you want this feeling of this crazy freight train headed towards the fucking sun, you're gonna have to accept that people kill each other because it's the same. It's the same thing.
Oh God. We couldn't have done it without you.
We couldn't have done it without
you. We couldn't have done it without
you. It's just, it's just such a gorgeous final line. Oh my God.
And I couldn't have done this podcast without you.
Oh, I simply could not do it alone.
we've talked for an incredibly long amount of time, and I'm sure
I've got no saliva left, but a lot of dreams still in my heart.
We've talked a little bit about Operation Mincemeat, but how and where could people get tickets?
I'd love to plug my show. Thank you so much. So it's on at the Fortune Theatre as of March. So you go to operationmincemeat.com, you can buy all the tickets, and indeed you must, and find out how much my own musical theatre critique adds up to my own show. Don't expect Chicago, but do expect murders.
Oh, there is murder.
And
what's the general plot of Operation Mincemeat?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Says the girl who's seen it four times.
So it's based, it's a kind of a crazy spy caper based on a true story of an operation that happened in, during World War II, where the Allies were losing the war spectacularly, and then a crazy scheme was cooked up by a couple of hopefuls to dress up a dead man as a Allied soldier, throw him in the sea with some fake plans and hope that the Germans might just find him, believe all the fake stories and move loads of troops so that we could invade a place we wanted to invade. And it's completely crazy, ridiculous story, but it is completely true.
And if you think you've seen a film about that starring Colin Firth, no, you haven't.
No, you haven't. Boring. All I can say is that Colin Firth plays my part, and yes. I say not as well. I mean, I've not watched it, but I imagine from reports.
No,
I've
you
had
can't
from,
watch it.
I can't watch it. It's too
like,
weird.
I can't watch that Carey Mulligan movie, Promising Young Woman. Weird. I'm never going to watch that.
No, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. But yeah, so we play. It's lots of like gender swapping and like multi-rolling. It's a big, fun, silly night out. It's all the things. The reason that I, you know, love Chicago and all this stuff so much is because we've always just wanted to put on huge, big nights out for people that are really, really fun. So yeah, come and watch it. And if that doesn't happen for you, just don't tell me. And well, that's fair for everyone.
You'll laugh, you'll cry. There's K-pop Nancys.
There are K-pop Nancys. That's true.
Thank you, Tash.
Thank you, Caro. Love you.
Love you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram @Zaraline.